You're listening to the Newsmakers podcast from MLB.com.
This is The Rocket, Bill Latson. Welcome to Newsmakers. We have a lot going on today. First, we pay tribute to Don Baylor, Darren Dalton, and Lee May. All three passed away recently. We have Hall of Famers Tracy Ringlesby and Claire Smith help us remember Baylor. We also have Yankee broadcaster Ken Singleton give us his memories on Baylor and May. Then we turn to Mickey Morandini, who gives us his best stories on Dalton. Then I talked to the current players. I saw the Dodgers recently, and I spoke to Kenley Jansen, Dave Roberts, and Chris Taylor. You get an understanding why the Dodgers have the best record in baseball. I also had a good conversation with Texas Rangers third baseman Adrian Beltre, who reached a milestone recently. We start with Tracy Ringlesby, who considered Don Baylor his best friend. Enjoy the podcast. We are remembering Don Baylor, and on the phone is Tracy Ringlesby. He's a columnist for MLB.com. Tracy, thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, no problem. I'm glad to be here with you, pal.
Tracy, you were a good friend of Baylor's, and matter of fact, I'll go far to say you guys were almost best friends. And why were you guys able to hit it off?
I don't know. It makes no sense. I mean, you got a white boy from Wyoming with very little experience of the real challenges in life, and you have an African-American, very strong man from the state of Texas that went through integrating public schools in the state of Texas, even when his older brother and sister wouldn't. So you got two people that are probably as different a background as you could ever find, but for whatever reason, there became a real common bond between us. Maybe it's because we just liked each other and there wasn't any real other reason. I don't know, but I won't say I'm anybody's. I won't say I was his best friend, but he was one of my two or three best friends. I can't speak for him because I think he's probably got thousands of best friends. The type of person he was.
Now talk about him with the Angels. That's where you covered him originally. What was so special, especially about 1979? That was his MVP year, and what a year he had.
Well, he just walked in, and it was like, oh, somebody's in charge. I mean, it wasn't. Yeah, I can still remember a player that I won't mention his name, but when I covered Texas, said to me, okay, you've been around Hal McCray, you've been around Don Baylor, what do I have to do to be a leader? And I said, and he's a good guy, and I go, you know what, you can't be. He said, why? I go, because you ask.
Wow.
And I said, you know, guys like Don Baylor, they just walk in and there's an aura. There's this presence. They don't announce that they're a leader. They don't tell everybody they're going to be in charge, but they just do. And a lot of it comes from their actions, and that's what it was like with the Angels. It was just this physical, big, strong guy, but for all of that, there's also the kindest, nicest person you could ever see. And, you know, in 79, probably the one incident that stands out that showed what he was. I mean, you've been around Don. He's a gentle giant, I guess you could say, or he was a gentle giant.
Yes.
And we're playing in Kansas City with about 11 games to go, and the Royals have won three consecutive division titles, and the Angels had come into existence in 1961, had never finished first ever.
Mm-hmm.
And Nolan's pitching, and in like the third or fourth inning, with two outs, nobody on base, Jimmy Anderson lets a ground ball go between his legs for an error. And they wind up scoring in that inning and beating the Angels. So after the game, here's 22-year-old Jimmy Anderson, and there's traveling media because it's the end and there's a pennant race at stake and there's all these people around him. And all of a sudden you hear this noise and you turn around and the spread table, the post-game meal table, has been turned over on Baylor's. Baylor's like real loud. It's real out of character for him. And everybody scurries over to Don Baylor. And he starts going off on something. And everyone leaves, and I'm still standing there, and he winks and smiles. I go, what was that all about? He goes, that kid's our shortstop. That's who we have to win with. He doesn't need to think about what happened tonight. He needs to think about what he can do tomorrow. He doesn't need to feel like he cost this team a game because he's one of only 25 players on this team. We all cost this team a game, not just him.
Wow.
And he goes, I had to get people focused on something other than him. And when I was walking out, Davey Howells, who was a visiting clubhouse guy, goes, he gave me double. He asked me how much the spread cost. He gave me double before before you guys came in.
Wow. I mean,
it was just his way of trying to protect the player there and put the heat on himself. But, you know, that even, it's hard for me to say because it's hard for me to fully understand what he grew up in. But let's look at it this way. Here's an African-American, Austin, Texas, early 60s, junior high school, volunteers along with two other kids to integrate the public schools. His older brother and sister were afraid to do it.
Mm-hmm.
He did it. He becomes the first African-American to ever play at Stephen F. Austin High School in athletics.
Right.
He's the first African-American that Darryl Royal ever gave a scholarship to play football. I can't imagine. You have a better feel than I do, okay? I cannot imagine what emotionally he had to go through at times with as nasty and horrid as people can act about things.
Mm-hmm.
When he was the only African American, when he was the when he's that age, and to have known him and to be around him, I'm going to say this at the funeral on Saturday. I said, you know, he's the closest thing I'll ever come to being around Jackie Robinson or Martin Luther King, because for all the things that he could have been bitter about and all the things that he could have got sidetracked on, he wasn't. He knew what he'd been through.
Mm-hmm.
But he knew where he was going, and he was trying to bring other people with him. And, you know, it goes back to when he was at Boston. And Ellis Burks is a rookie. And Ellis Burks came, when he came to the Rockies, I go, why don't you come here as a free agent? He goes, I'll go anywhere Don Baylor is. I told my agent, just get it done with the Rockies. I want to play for Don. Because when Ellis was a rookie in Boston, it was the 1 year Don was there. And the Red Sox were known as the team that took 25 players with 25 cabs, and they hazed rookies. And early in that season, Don got tired of it, and he called out a couple of their veteran players in the clubhouse in front of everybody else. And he explained to them that Ellis Burks was one of 25 people on that team, and all 25 people were equal, and we needed all 25 people to win, and Ellis Burks would be a member of the team and treated just like everybody else from that day on.
Wow.
And if you don't want to do it, we can go outside right now and decide who has the authority in this clubhouse.
Wow, that's amazing, Tracy. Tracy, you know, when I think of Don Baylor, I remember something Don Mattingly told me in the early 90s. You know, he called Don Baylor one of his best teammates, and that Baylor never thought about race. He never thought about black and white. And when you mention that story, I think of what Don Mattingly told me about Don Baylor years ago, and this guy had no bitterness. I mean, I don't recall him saying anything bad about a white person or anybody. So,
well, I mean, that's why I say. I mean, that to me, that's why I say to me, he was the Jackie Robinson or the Martin Luther King that I'll have in my life.
Right, right.
Because I can't, like I said, environment I grew up in, I can't imagine, I can't dream of what he had to go through, but to think that he could be as strong and move forward and never be distracted by that just tells you the strength and you know, the positive impact he's had on so many lives around him.
No doubt about it.
But it wasn't like he wasn't a hard-nosed guy. You know, I remember once when Hal McCray was a hitting coach in Philadelphia and Don was managing the Rockies. So I'm talking to Mac, who I had covered in Kansas City in 76 and then 83, 84, and 85. And I'm mentioning Baylor, and he goes, yeah, I never met him. I go, and I started laughing. He goes, what are you laughing about? I go, yet you never met him. He goes, I never met him. I go, hold it. You're both African-American. You're both designated hitters. Your careers coincided in the American League. You never met him? He goes, no. I go, why? He goes, well, why would I? So I'm going to see Don later on. I mentioned, and he goes, well, yeah, we were never teammates. There was no reason for us to ever meet. So, I mean, he was a competitor.
Mm-hmm.
There was a toughness about him. And I guess you have to be tough to be that kind, right?
Right.
And I can remember once, you know, before TV got to what it was, so the TV guy says, hey, will you do a pregame interview for us? We'll tape it about 2:30. He goes, yeah, where do you want to do it? He goes, oh, over by the Giants dugout. He goes, that's not my side of the field.
He
wouldn't go over there. Or the other, my other favorite is Bobby Grich was a first-round choice. He was a second. they were roommates all the way through the minor leagues together. Bobby is the godfather to Don's son. They were roommates in the big leagues, and Don gets traded to Oakland. And the next year, they both come to the Angels as free agents. And Gritchie, we're talking about Don. He only charged them out twice out of 267 times, and he's hit by a pitch. And both times he charged, he was hit in the head.
Right.
And so Gritchie goes, yeah. He'd just take it out on the second baseman or the shortstop.
Right.
He said, in fact, he goes to Oakland, he gets hit by a pitch, I'm at shortstop with the Orioles, or second base with the Orioles, and I look over, and he's shaking his head, yes, like, get out of my way, because I'm coming into second base. And I'm like, hold on, I'm the godfather to your son.
That's amazing. Hey, what kind of manager was he? Now, I know he took the Rockies to the playoffs, but I don't think, in my opinion, he had the talent. He didn't have any pitching for sure. What do you think?
Well, here's the bottom line is people will say, well, how did he handle his pitching? How do you know? I mean, that was Mile High Stadium to begin with, where it was like 240 feet to left field in the way the ball carries here, and then the early years of Coors Field before the humidor.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to joke about it, but it was true. We used to call them Baylor saves. And, you know, if they were in a tough situation in the fifth inning, Steve Reed was the setup man for the closer.
Right.
Steve Reed might pitch the fourth or fifth inning because Don's attitude was, you know, I've got to stop. I can't let the game get out of hand because as long as we're within three or four runs, we have a chance to win. But if it gets to seven or eight, we're done.
Mm-hmm.
And so the players called them Baylor saves. They loved him. You know, they'd do whatever they could for him. I think he was a great manager at Coors Field because he was an offensive type guy. He wasn't afraid of situations. He wasn't intimidated by situations. He didn't get caught up with what the book said.
Right.
He tried to make his decisions based off his people. And I don't know that anybody had more loyalty than Don had from the players or from the coaches when he was a manager. In fact, and I don't even know if the Pirates – I mean, I know the Pirates know about this, but I don't think it's been out there. Clint Hurdle called, and he's like, so are you going into Austin for the funeral? I go, yeah, I'm going to speak at it. He goes, okay, I'll be in Thursday night.
Mm-hmm.
I go, it's Saturday. He goes, yeah, but team's in Toronto, and team's going to Toronto, and if I'm going to be there Saturday morning, I got to come in Friday anyhow. We have a day game on Thursday. I'm coming in. He's going to miss two games as a manager of a team. But I teased him about it. He goes, Tracy, I'm not managing a team if Don Baylor doesn't give me the confidence and give me the opportunity in the big leagues that I have.
Wow.
He said, I'll do anything. He said, I can't stay late Saturday for all the festivities. I can be there for the funeral, but I have a Willie Prater function. You know, he has a daughter with Willie Prater syndrome.
Right.
In Toronto on Sunday morning before the game, so I have to get to Toronto on Saturday night.
Wow.
So, I mean, it would be real easy for Hurdle to say, you know what, I'm managing a big league team. I just can't get away.
Right.
But Don Baylor means so much to him.
Right, right.
That he's going to make the concessions to be there. And I don't know, in a strange way, I mean, that might be as strong a testimony as to what people who were around Don Baylor feel about him.
Tracy, the final question. Baylor was, I read your story, and Baylor was upset with you that you revealed what hospital he was in. And could you talk about that? He was thinking about the nurses, not himself.
Well, yeah, I mean, this goes back to him. He's diagnosed with multiple myeloma. And as a former manager of the Rockies, that's a major event, you know, I mean, the people loved him. I mean, when Don Baylor came back as a hitting coach with the Braves after being fired by the Rockies,
mm-hmm.
like you walk into the press box, you know, you go through the tunnels downstairs and stuff.
Right.
All anybody was talking about was, you know, Don and Becky are going to be here tonight. I mean, I'm talking ushers, ticket takers, the cleaning people. They were so excited that Don Baylor was going to be back because that's the way he treated people. And I think the hospital underscores that and that, you know, I put it in the paper that he was in the hospital. He's recovering from multiple myeloma, or he was diagnosed with multiple myeloma. And he calls the next day, and he goes, I can't believe you wrote that. I go, Don, these people care about you. I can't just, like, ignore the fact. I mean, you're still very popular, very well thought of in Colorado. He goes, well, it's not. I don't care if you wrote about me. He goes, but why'd you have to put the hospital name in? I go, are people bothering you? He goes, no, but these poor nurses, all these flowers that people keep sending, you know how much these nurses are having to carry them around? You don't think they have enough work to do without having to carry these flowers all over?
Wow.
I mean, he was so concerned about putting somebody else out, and here he is laying in the hospital bed with multiple myeloma. But that was his thought, because that was Don Baylor. He was always more worried about the other person than he was himself. He never felt that he was important. And you know what, Billy, maybe that's why he was so important to so many people.
Wow.
One more story, but we talk about, you know, he integrated the public schools. He was the first black athlete at Stephen F. Austin High School. I don't remember a spring training. I don't remember an all-star game or a postseason game or a season opening game where Frank Seal and Ann Seal, Frank was his high school baseball coach, weren't there as Don's guests. And he never forgot the impact they had on his life and what they meant to him.
Unbelievable.
And, you know, it's just, the man was just, that's how special he was.
Tracy, listen, thank you so much, and we know you had the great memories, and thanks for sharing it with us.
Oh, no problem.
Thank you so much.
My next guest is Claire Smith. She was Baylor's biographer, and she has a lot to say about Baylor's time with the Yankees. Enjoy the podcast.
We are remembering Don Baylor, and on the phone is Hall of Famer Claire Smith. Claire, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, Bill. I wish it was a happier occasion, but it warms my heart that so many people want to talk about Don.
Claire, the first thing, when I think of you, I think of the autobiography you wrote with Don Baylor, and it was a great book. And what stood out to me was that he was honest. He didn't hold back. He said some not-so-kind things about Jim Rice, and among other things. And I'd like to know, why were you able to write this book?
Well, you're talking about a gentleman who, in 19 years, I don't think pulled a reporter aside one single time and said, I want to tell you something, but you can't use my name.
Right.
He never went off the record. And when he said something, he meant it. And even if it caused a riff or some controversy, he never said that he was misquoted or what have you. So Don had rules for the book. We weren't to go into the clubhouse because he honored that privacy that teammates should expect from each other. He wouldn't get into people's personal lives. That to him was off limits. But his generosity in, I think, dedicating 60% or more of the book, not to himself, but to the people who he played with, played for, admired, and could shed some insight onto some truly iconic people of his generation. If you remember, there were entire chapters devoted to individuals. Reggie had a chapter.
Right.
Billy Verl had a chapter. Frank and Brooks, because he admired them and he wanted the world to see these folks unvarnished, really, but through his eyes and through his experiences with them.
Now, you covered the Yankees for the Hartford Courant when you met Don Baylor. Is that correct?
Yes. I started in 82, and if memory serves, my memory's not that great anymore, but he arrived in 83 as a free agent.
That is correct. And could you talk about those 3 years you covered him? It was productive years, but what bothered me the most was 1985, when Billy Martin, and who I think is the best manager ever, but he did one dumb thing, platooning Don Baylor with Dan Pasqua. I mean, that was ridiculous. Could you talk about that?
Well, you know that Don, thank you. Don and Billy had an interesting, strained relationship, to say the least. And there was a lot of pressure being applied from upstairs. George Steinbrenner, if he loved you, managers didn't touch you. And if he felt challenged by you or had a dispute with you at any particular time, then managers were often told what to do, how to use you, for non-baseball reasons. Don was strong in the union, and if you remember, George had tried to force some things on the team that went against the union regulations, such as making 25 players sign releases that they would agree to drug testing. And that was back in the cocaine era. It had nothing to do with steroids. The team pushed back hard. The union pushed back hard. So Don had his confrontations with management. He certainly was in Yogi's camp. He loved Yogi Berra. So when that transition, that ugly transition occurred in 85, Don was very vocal about Billy coming in, about the way Yogi was let go, about the fact that Billy brought in Willie Horton and declared him to be a tranquility coach. That was a really indirect threat to anyone in uniform who thought that they might confront Billy. Billy always thought in terms of physical confrontation, but he knew he was walking in a clubhouse that had Baylor and had Griffey and Dave Winfield and some pretty volatile but well set in their ways veterans. So that was the history behind it. The Yankees always had rifts and controversy going in the 80s. If you recall, the Yankees had the best record in the 1980s and yes, never made the playoffs. Don told me that other teams counted on that one day, one week, one series in which the Yankees would blow up in the clubhouse, have a controversy or so, and they other teams used that to wriggle by the Yankees in the standings. And we covered a lot of close races back in the 80s, and the Yankees would sometimes go into the final series of the season still with playoff hopes. But there was always that one explosion mid-season, August, July, that derailed the team.
Or September,
yes. Whether it was Eddie Whitson breaking Billy's arm or
correct,
Billy getting into bar situations or having feuds with this player, that player, players demanding trades, players ending up in tears, or just rages like Goose Gossage and the famous take it upstairs to the fat man quote, yeah, which came after a doubleheader sweep of the Chicago White Sox. And we all expected a nice, tranquil clubhouse, and it turned out to be anything but, because there was always an undercurrent of anger between the players and management.
Claire, what made Don Baylor a winner? Because it seems like everywhere he went, he was going to the postseason, three straight World Series with three different teams. What made him a winner, in your opinion?
There was such a calm demeanor about him, but when it came to being old school baseball, he learned at the at the side of Frank Robinson on one side and Brooks Robinson on the other. Remember, Frank started the kangaroo court system,
yes,
that lightened the atmosphere in the clubhouses everywhere, but it also enforced baseball rules. If you violated a baseball rule that you should have been aware of, you got fined in the kangaroo court. And at the end of the season, they used all the money to go out and have a team party or what have you. But Frank was the original kangaroo court judge, and Don played that role on every team he played for from then on. And people listened. It was like that old commercial where people leaned in to hear, stockbroker tips, but they were listening to baseball tips with Don. They were watching the way he carried himself on the field, hit by pitch 267 times and rubbed once because the pitch came out of Nolan Ryan's hands. He would put nonsense on the field he would bring it to a screeching halt if people were throwing at Yankees' shoulders up, because to him that was just forbidden. That was verboten. You were not allowed to do that. And he would just say so quietly after such a game. You'd have to lean in to hear him, but he would say, well, you know, such and such a pitcher had better apologize to his second baseman and shortstop, because that's where the retribution will come. He was a notoriously vicious base runner, like Frank Robinson. He learned so much from Frank, but Donnie wouldn't, he learned not to charge the mound. He did that very early in his career, and Earl Weaver tried to tell him that that would shorten his career and really ruin his reputation in baseball, and he'd probably get hurt in a brawl. So mm-hmm. he learned to take out his aggression at the plate and on the base paths. Probably would be illegal. Some of the slides that he used to take would probably be illegal today. But Donnie, he also pointed to an article he read in a magazine, airline magazine of all places, an article about Steve Garvey. And Steve was talking about controlled aggression. Steve knew his batting average on pitches immediately after being brushed back or hit, and he said that's how he got his retribution. And Don really took that to heart. He took it. He took his aggression to the plate and the base pass play within the rules, but he made it very clear: don't throw. You can hit me, just don't hit me shoulders and up.
Right.
And the way he protected players in the clubhouse, the famous story I'm sure Tracy told you about the 22-year-old shortstop who committed
yes.
some really awful plays during a pennant race with the Angels, and he was being peppered. This young man was being peppered with questions, and Don, being one of the leaders of the Angels, threw a temper tantrum purposely to draw the media away from the shortstop. And once the media gathered, Don just calmed down and told them that what the state of the team was, and that the team was going to be okay. And right. Tracy later asked him, what was that all about? And he said, we need that shortstop going for, we need that kid going forward. That's right. What he did. He had that kind of vision
mm-hmm.
and he had that kind of caring nature towards his teammates.
Amazing. Claire Smith, listen, thank you so much, and it's great that you and Don Baylor were really great friends, and thank you so much for everything.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you for having me.
Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
My next guest is Ken Singleton. He played with Don Baylor and Lee May in Baltimore. He had a lot to say about both of them. Enjoy the podcast. On the phone is Ken Singleton. He's a broadcaster for the New York Yankees. But we're not here to talk about the Yankees. We're here to talk about Don Baylor and Lee May. And Ken, thank you so much for being on the show.
Bill, it's my pleasure. Certainly two of my most valued teammates over the years, and two fantastic guys, great locker room presence, both of them. Just not even speaking of what they were able to do on the field, which was quite extraordinary.
Now, you had the pleasure of playing with both of them. Let's start with Lee May. Talk about the kind of person Lee May was.
Lee was, in fact, he got traded to the Orioles the day before I did. And I remember talking with Mike Torres and saying, oh, the Orioles got Lee May. They're going to be a strong team. I mean, he is such a productive player. Little did we know if we both would be traded to Baltimore the very next day. And my first impression of Lee May was when walked into the clubhouse in spring training, this was a very strong man, very powerful man. Not only that, as far as his physical ability, but he was a strong presence in the clubhouse. He had a way of starting up trouble, if you will, in the clubhouse by starting arguments, would take phony arguments with teammates just to take the pressure off before big games. And he was very good at that. It would make you not think about the upcoming game itself, but what was going on at the moment in the clubhouse. And it was all in fun. I can recall four of us used to sit in the back of the bus on the way to airports and hotels. It was Lee, myself, Pat Kelly, and Don Stanhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And we would sit there. And one day I said to Lee, how come you sit all the way back here? And he said, it's as far away from authority as you can get. And I just thought that was just Lee in a nutshell. He was very funny, short to the point. Another story. One thing he always used to say, if he didn't strike out 100 times in a season, whichever team employed him, in this case it was the Orioles, they would think he wasn't trying. So one day I'm sitting and I just struck out myself, and I'm walking down. I'm kind of ticked off, and I'm going down to get a drink at the water fountain. He's sitting there, and he's smiling. He's looking up at me, smiling. I said, what are you so happy about? And he said, well, last time up I struck out my 100th time. I'll be back next year. So I said to him, you'd be happy about striking out 100 times. I'm trying to avoid striking out 100 times. But he was that type of guy, very funny. He could take a moment with a lot of pressure and just depressurize it. And very funny man, and just really, really was a great, great teammate.
When you
productive, too.
When you think of Lee May, you think of the home runs and the RBIs, but I get the impression that he was a mentor to people like Eddie Murray. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, most definitely. When Eddie came to spring training, his first big league spring training in 1977, he was not supposed to make the team. And he was so prolific during spring training that Earl Weaver said that he wanted him on the team. And, of course, Eddie went on to be Rookie of the Year that year and on his way to a Hall of Fame career. But it was Lee May who actually played Eddie's position. Lee May was the first baseman, and Eddie was the first baseman. But that particular year, Earl Weaver made Eddie the DH more often than not.
Right.
The next year, that's when he flipped him. Lee May became the DH, and Eddie took over at first base. But Lee took it upon himself to show Eddie the ropes. And one thing he told him, is that rookies they're seen and not heard. So about a month into the season, Earl Weaver went up to Lee and said, does this kid ever talk? And Lee said, well, he's just following my orders that just to be seen and not heard. And certainly Eddie was seen a lot because, as I said, he had a Rookie of the Year campaign in his initial season. I can't overestimate how much Lee meant to the team on a daily basis. He was one of those solid veterans that every team should have. Just thinking about him now, it just brings back some great memories. Just a fantastic person.
Do you remember the last time you saw him?
No, it was years ago. It's probably when he was coaching the Rays. He was on Hal McRae's staff with the Rays, and I can remember, he was sitting there smoking a cigarette like he usually did, and I said to him, Lee, you got to quit smoking those cigarettes, and he looked at me and said, I'll quit smoking them when they stop making them, and that's basically the way he was. He was just that type of guy.
Unfortunately, we lost Don Baylor this week. And you were a teammate of his for the 1 year, but I'm sure you got to know him, the next 30 years. Could you talk about what was it like to be a teammate of his that 1 year?
Well, when I first got traded to Baltimore, of course, when you're just trying to fit in, when you come to a new team, and I got traded over the winter, so I was there for spring training. And Don was one of the players on the team. And the Orioles were a very tight team, very, very solid, very good. I walked in the clubhouse the first day, and I could see all these fantastic players, and including Don. And he made it he welcomed me to the team. He told me where my wife and I should live in Baltimore, around the Baltimore area. He tried to explain to me what it was going to be like playing for Earl Weaver, and he was right. He was tough, but he was certainly the best manager I ever played for. But Don became a trusted teammate. He was not only a great player, he could do everything on the field. I mean, he could run. He could play defense. The only thing he couldn't do is throw. He had hurt his arm playing football.
Yeah, I remember
but
that.
He could run, and he was powerful. I can recall, Bill, that we had a game in Boston. It was the last game of the series, and in Don's last at-bat, he hit a home run. The next night we played in Detroit. His first three times up, he hit three home runs. So, in other words, he hit four home runs in a row in two different cities. And the thing about it, he hit them off four different pitchers, which his nickname was The Groove, and he certainly was in The Groove for those particular two games. When he got hot, it was like a sight to behold. Just line drive after line drive, a few home runs sprinkled in, and he could carry a team. Much in the same way that Frank Robinson did before I got to the Orioles and was, of course, a prolific Hall of Famer. But Donnie was just, when he got hot, he was just wonderful to watch.
When he was traded to the Oakland A's, he was traded for Reggie Jackson. What was the clubhouse reaction during that time?
Well, that happened during spring training, and we were playing a night game in Miami, and I was playing right field, and Donnie started the game in left field. But after the third inning, he was taken out of the game, and I didn't remember him being injured. So in between innings, I walked up to the clubhouse, and he was sitting over in the corner in the trainer's table, not on the table, but on the floor, just sitting there bawling his eyes out. And I didn't know what the problem was. I thought maybe one of his relatives had passed away or something catastrophic had happened, and he told me he'd been traded. And this is for the first trade for a player is the toughest one. I mean, he was a lifelong Oriole, came through the organization, and I asked him, well, where are you going? He said, I'm going to Oakland. And then I said, who are we getting? He said, well, you're getting Reggie. And I thought, oh, man, we're getting Reggie on our team? And this certainly was a big trade. It turned out to be Don Baylor and Mike Torres for Ken Holtzman and Reggie.
Right.
And it was the first year of free agency, and Charlie Finley was getting rid of all of his potential free agents. And I think Baylor was a potential free agent as well. He was really upset that he had gone to Oakland. I will say this, Bill. I mean, I know that Don played for several teams and coached and managed in several organizations. And I think that's a good thing because all of these organizations got to experience what it meant to have Don Baylor on their side. And he's the type of player and manager and coach. He was no nonsense. It was all about winning, and it was all about hard playing the game right. And I think through his expertise and his determination, a lot of organizations got pointed in the right direction, at least while he was there. And I think in that way, all of baseball, not just the Orioles, benefited from having Don Baylor around.
You know, everywhere he went, the teams always were going to the postseason. There was a three-year mm-hmm. period where he was going to the World Series with three different teams. I mean, why do you think teams loved his game?
He's a winner. Most often the teams he was on, they were winning teams. That continued on when he was managing coaching. It's kind of hard to explain, but people would gravitate towards him, and he would always know the right thing to say. Although he was a tough, tough guy, the exterior was tough, he was very compassionate. And he would help you at the drop of a hat. And I think that not only went with me when I first joined the team, but I think it continued throughout his career in the major leagues, no matter what his job was. And I just think that he touched a lot of people, and you're seeing that with all the condolences from players that he played against and the feelings of the players that he managed. Mm-hmm. I saw a clip with Joe Girardi the other day on the YES Network. And Joe, of course, he managed Joe when Joe was playing in Colorado.
Right.
And Joe was kind of tearing up when he was talking about Don Baylor. And I'm sure that I remember turning on the TV on Monday morning when I saw that he had passed away. And it just took me back to a lot of good memories and, it kind of choked me up a little bit that this teammate and just fantastic person in our game is now gone. But, mm-hmm. He made such an impact that people are going to remember him forever.
Ken Singleton, listen, thank you so much for helping us remember Lee May and Don Baylor. Thank you so much.
Yeah, two strong men. They're going to be missed.
My next guest is Mickey Morandini. He's the first base coach of the Philadelphia Phillies. He shares his memories of the late Darren Dalton. Enjoy the podcast.
We remember Darren Dalton, who passed away on Sunday. And on the phone is his former teammate, Mickey Morandini. He's currently a Phillies first base coach. He was an underrated player with the Cubs and Phillies, and he's on the phone now. Mickey, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Mickey, tell me, when you say the name Darren Dalton, what comes to mind?
Well, for me, he's obviously a special friend, and he was really a father figure to me throughout my entire baseball career. I was lucky enough to play with Darren for almost 7 full years. So for me, just a grinder, obviously a great leader. I think his best quality was his leadership in and out of that clubhouse, and just a guy. He went through 9 knee surgeries. And I know in 92 and 93, he caught 145 and 147 games. So that's something you just don't see anymore. So just a grinder, a guy that wanted to win, and wanted his teammates to be as good as they could be. Just a great guy.
Now talk about, you said he was a father figure to you. What were the things that he taught you on and off the field?
Well, you know, he taught me how to deal with the media. He taught me how to play hurt. And here's a guy that, like I said, had 9 knee surgeries and would catch night games and then come back the next day in the middle of July and catch a day game. So he really taught me how to play hurt and realize the difference between soreness and pain and things like that. And just really how to play the game. I've told the story when I first came up early in my career, I was a platoon player at second base. I was only playing against right-handers, but I was fortunate enough to get a start against a lefty one day, and there was a runner on second base, and I came up and I bunted him over to third base. And after the game, Darren came right up to me and said, "Hey man," he goes, "do you want to play every day?" And I was like, "Yeah, I'm gonna play every day." And he said, "Well, by you bunting off left-handers, that's not proven to the ownership here and the management that you can hit left-handed pitching." He goes, "You got to swing the bat there and get a base hit and drive that runner in and show the team that you can hit left-handed pitching." And it was just little things like that. He really cared about his teammates, and really the main goal for him was winning baseball.
And, you know, you mentioned something else, too. This guy played hurt. Even during the 93 pennant-winning team, this guy had some knee problems, but he managed to play. And as teammates, you guys had to feel good about that.
Oh, yeah, and that's what really made him such a great leader was, you know, when we saw him, you know, in the training room after a long night game with ice bags on his knees and his shoulder, and then, like I said, he'd come in the next day, he'd see his name was not in the lineup, he'd go right into the manager's office and say, "Hey, I feel fine, I can play today," and Vuk, our bench coach, would come out and change the lineup. So just little things like that, just the way he you know, he went about his business in that clubhouse. I'll tell you right now, if you came into that clubhouse after a win and you were 0-4 and moping around, there was no place for that in Darren's clubhouse. He would come right up to you and take care of it right away. So winning was really, like I said, winning was what it was all about for Darren.
You guys were on the 93 Phillies. Could you talk about how special that team was? And you guys came close to going all the way.
Yeah, it really was a special team. Every major publication had us coming in last that year, but we had brought in some really key players in Eisenreich and Thompson and Incavilla. And Danny Jackson and just veteran players that knew how to play the game. And just from day one, everything clicked. We had a real good mix of veteran players and young players, you know, like me and Stocker and Schilling and Ben Rivera and other guys. So, you know, we got off to a really good start, and then the city got behind us, and we just kind of took off from there. We played the game the right way. We really did. We played hard. We knew how to play the game. You know, like Darren, for instance, had a career year. He had over 100 RBIs. And I think he drew 117 walks. Mm-hmm. The year Lenny Dykstra had, he was MVP-type player that year. So just everything clicked, and we got along real well. And I had great coaching, and, you know, we were one game away from winning the whole thing.
Then Darren goes to the Marlins, where he wins a World Series, but he plays first base. And I saw something that shocked me. He was stealing bases. And for some reason, I'm sure that didn't surprise you.
you know, it didn't. Like I said, it was all about winning there. If there was an opportunity to take an extra base, he would do it. And we all knew Darren was coming towards the end of his career. You know, his knees just couldn't take much more at that point. But like you said, he was playing more first base, and for him to take that extra base by stealing a base doesn't surprise me at all. And if there was one guy that deserved to go out with the World Championship, it was definitely Darren Dalton.
When was the last time you saw Darren Dalton before he passed away?
You know, I do the Phillies Fantasy Camp down in Florida in January, and he was kind enough to come by and see some of the guys. And at that point, he was okay. He was starting to walk on a cane a little bit, and his speech was starting to, you know, slur a little bit. So I knew at that point in January that, you know, things weren't going real well. But just a fighter, man. He was a fighter. He fought this thing for a long, long time. And I just, you know, I love him like a father. He was a close friend, and it was heartbreaking to hear of his passing. And, you know, the organization and the city of Philadelphia are definitely going to miss him.
And, you know, it seems to me that he had a positive attitude throughout that illness. And I always think that is a great idea to have a positive attitude. Could you talk about it?
Yeah, I think so. I think any time you have an illness or something that, you know, may lead to, you know, you dying at some point, I think you have to take as much positive attitude. And I think that can lead to, you know, longer life. But I know Darren, you know, he would, no matter at what point he was in this illness, would come up to you and hug you and kiss you and say, I love you, man. And boy, that's, you know, when you have someone that's sick like that and coming up to you and smiling and giving you a hug and a kiss, that's just, it's very inspiring.
And the final question, what do you want people to remember when it comes to Darren Dalton?
Well, there's so many things. I just think a winner. He was a winner. He was a winner. He was a fighter and a grinder. And he was one of he was the ultimate baseball player. He knew how to lead. He knew how to play the game. He knew how to make his teammates better. Just a great, great person that really cared about everybody.
Mickey Morandini. Listen, thank you so much. We appreciate you sharing your stories about Darren Dalton. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for having me on.
Take care. My next guest is Dave Roberts. He's the manager of the Dodgers. And you get an understanding why the Dodgers have the best record in baseball. Enjoy the podcast. Thank you so much for being on the show. This has been a dream season for you and the Dodgers. What has been the key this season?
The key to us at this point is, you know, everyone shows up each day for each other with one goal in mind, and that's to win a baseball game. And we, along with every other team, is, you know, you go through adversities and injuries, but, you know, nothing allows us to waver.
Now, everyone expected you guys to be in the postseason. Are you surprised by the record? It's the best record in baseball.
You know, I would say that I didn't expect us to have this record. I don't think that when we started the season, you know, I had a number in mind anyway. I just felt for us to go out there and play a certain brand of baseball, we were going to win more than we were going to lose. And but obviously when you look at the win-loss, it's pretty exciting.
Sure is. You have two guys on your current roster who are not on your opening day roster. I'm talking about Chris Taylor and Cody Bellinger. Talk about their impact.
Both those guys have had amazing impacts, you know, not only in the clubhouse, obviously on the field, and, you know, with what they've done in the batter's box, defensively, giving me the flexibility, and on the bases, they're both winning players. And I think that with the core of guys that we already have on our team, those guys fit in seamlessly, and they've made us considerably better.
Cody Bellinger especially did not have a good spring training. What is he doing now to become an impact player?
Well, I think that his at-bat quality is very consistent, and he didn't have a great spring. But 2 years ago, he had a great spring. And so I think that he's a baseball player, and whatever it takes to help us win a baseball game, he does. And I think that he's not afraid. You know, so being a young player here on a contending team, he fits right in, and there's a lot of confidence there.
What about Chris Taylor?
Chris Taylor, you know, has been up and down the last few years in the big leagues and, you know, reinventing his swing and just kind of just the confidence that he has and the blue collar mindset that he has. It's just something that, you know, Chase Utley, Justin Turner, Corey Seager, they have that sort of same DNA, and he's a winning player.
I know Adrian Gonzalez is in rehab now. How do you expect him to fit in when he comes back?
Adrian's going to fit in. You know, Adrian's a big part of what we've done, what we're doing, and how I use him. I don't know exactly right now, but I know that, you know, going forward, he's going to be a big part of what we're doing. And you know, where we're at right now, you know, we put ourselves in a situation where there's a lot of at-bats to be had.
Mm-hmm. And what about Clayton Kershaw? How's he doing?
Clayton's doing well. He's going to see us in Arizona when we get there on Tuesday. And he's not on the mound yet, but just talked to him today, and he's optimistic. And, you know, he'll get on the mound soon, and I expect him back, you know, soon enough.
You added more juice with Yu Darvish on your roster. Can you imagine Yu Darvish and Clayton Kershaw in the postseason?
Well, I hope I don't have to imagine it. I can't wait to see it. And, you know, Yu has really fit in really well with our ball club. And to see that start that he made the other night was special here at Citi Field. And I can't wait to see those guys go back to back.
What would you like to see improvement on with regarding this team? It's a tough question to ask, but and I know you're doing well. What do you like to see improve?
I think just continue to do a lot of what we've done. I mean, we're playing the game right, we're playing hard every day, and we're competing. And when you do that and you have the talent that we have on our club, you're going to win baseball games.
You've been in the World Series as a player. What would it mean to win the World Series as a manager?
Well, obviously, anytime you have a chance to, you know, even be in that conversation, have that conversation, it's special. And, you know, that's why we all play, and that's why we all coach. So that's everyone's goal.
Everyone looks at you as a father figure or brother. What do you do to make sure that everyone's relaxed in that clubhouse and on the field?
I think for me, the coaches, we're very positive. We love on the guys, and we're very supportive. And, you know, this game of baseball is tough. It's a tough game. And I think as a player, as a coach, you always have to take, you always have to remember what it's like to be a player. And I think our coaches do a great job of that.
My final question, you've done a great job as a manager. And I think, I'm just wondering, how could the Padres bypass you like that? I mean, it's a joke.
I don't know. You know what, I think that they have their reasons. You know, I still have some good friends over there. And, yeah, I'm from San Diego, and it seemed like it made sense, you know, for me to know that the organization, the city, but obviously they wanted to go in a different direction, and I guess one man's trash, another man's treasure. So I ended up in Los Angeles, and I couldn't be more excited.
Thank you so much.
All right.
My next guest is Chris Taylor, who's come out of nowhere to become one of the best players on the Dodgers. Enjoy the podcast. Chris Taylor, thank you so much for being on the show. First of all, you're from Virginia Beach, same town as Ryan Zimmerman, and Virginia Beach has a lot to be proud of this year. Could you talk about coming from Virginia Beach?
Yeah, you know, obviously, you know, coming up, I really looked up to a lot of those guys from my hometown, you know, Ryan Zimmerman, David Wright, Michael Kadire, the Upton brothers, Mark Reynolds, you know, the list goes on and on. I think that's just a testament to, you know, the coaching of Virginia Beach. And, you know, it's really kind of become a baseball environment there.
Who's your favorite player?
My favorite player growing up was David Wright. You know, I followed him. I watched him play in high school when I was a young kid and kind of followed him throughout his career with the Mets here. And, you know, I always loved the way he played the game.
He's had a great career. You agree?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, unbelievable player and even a better person.
You're finally getting a chance to play every day. Why did it take so long?
I think there was an adjustment period on my end, you know, that I had to make. I had to make a few changes into my swing and a little bit of a maturity process as well as the mental game and maintaining my confidence. And then also the opportunity has to be right. You know, I think everything happens for a reason. And, you know, unfortunately things didn't work for me in Seattle, but, you know, I'm happy being here in LA now.
Talk about the swing, the changes you made. What adjustment did you make, and when did it hit you that mentally you had to learn a lot in this game?
You know, every year I try to improve upon my game, and I've always tried to make little swing changes, but, you know, this year was definitely the most drastic changes I've made, and it's something I decided to do after talking to a lot of guys. You know, JT, he made that big swing change, and that turned his career around. And
Justin
then,
Turner.
Yes, Justin Turner. And then, you know, there's been other players as well. You know, JD Martinez is one of those guys. And, you know, just watching those guys and how, you know, they made those swing changes and it turned their careers around kind of inspired me. And I decided, you know, I wanted to make those changes and hopefully drive the ball and get it in the air a little more.
You have been a great leadoff hitter for this team. Could you talk about what it's like to play for the Dodgers this year? It's been a dream season for you and the team.
It's been a ton of fun, you know, especially the way we've been playing lately. You know, we're on quite a streak here. I think we've won 43 of our last 50 games. It's pretty incredible. And, you know, we just got a really good group of guys. It's so much fun to be a part of and to feel the energy and the confidence we have. You know, it's really something I've never been a part of. It's really special.
I watch you play on the field and I say, wow, look at that hustle. Look at the way you run. And it seemed like you hustle every day. You never take a play off. Where'd you get that work ethic?
That's just the way I was brought up, you know. You know, I was always one of the smaller kids when I was younger, so I had to play that way. If I wanted to compete with the bigger guys, you know, I knew I had to give it my all, and, you know, that's just something I never even really thought twice about. It's just something I do.
From a personal standpoint, what goals do you want to accomplish? I know you want to win the World Series, but I'm talking about personal goals.
I don't know. You know, my personal goal is to be here and help the team win, honestly. I can't be much more specific than that. You know, I think most of our goals are team goals, and I'm just happy to be here.
What can you say about Dave Roberts? He's the guy who took a chance on you. Could you talk about Dave Roberts?
Yeah, he's been awesome. You know, he's a great coach, great human being, and his energy and attitude is contagious all around the clubhouse. And I think, you know, he represents what we try to be here. You know, high energy, super positive, and he's a joy to play for.
Everyone talks about how he's like a father figure. Do you see it that way, or you see him as a friend, a brother?
I mean, I guess it could be taken either way. You know, he's definitely a guy I really look up to, and, you know, it's like I said, I really enjoy playing for him. He's fun to be around, and you know, I'm happy he's my manager.
I looked at your history. You come from a wrestling family, and I like to know how much do you like wrestling, and, you know, did you ever think about making it a career?
I grew up in a wrestling family, and I did it when I was a kid, but I always knew baseball is my true passion, and that's what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. What did you like about wrestling?
The competitive nature. I think it, you know, it kind of gave me contributed to my work ethic now. You know, it's wrestling's really hard work and very physically demanding, and you know, it makes me appreciate the hard work in baseball. Doesn't really seem like work, it's more fun. So I guess that's the best take I can have on it.
Do you have to pinch yourself sometimes to say, man, what am I doing? I mean, you're having a great year. Do you have to pinch yourself and say, man, I'm here?
No, every once in a while I look back and, you know,
it was a struggle.
Yeah, it was a grind for sure the last few years. You know, to all the work I put in to try to get here and stay here. And, you know, I'm just happy it's working out now.
Listen, Chris Taylor, thank you so much.
All right, thanks.
Take care, man. My next guest is closer Kenley Jansen, and he's really happy he re-signed with the Dodgers. Enjoy the podcast. Kenley Jansen, thank you so much for being on the show. Kenley, last year was great. This year is even better. Talk about playing for this Dodger team right now.
Man, this Dodger team is awesome, to be honest with you. It's funny. Like, me and JT talk about it when we were signed back. It seems like that we just kind of set the tone there in January that, you know, we want to be back here with this team too, because it's an unfinished business, and it's something special here with this team. The group of guys that we have is special. I mean, the way how they're playing, the way how they fight, they never quit. And, you know, we just talk about that, and next thing you know, we're doing it as a unit. So that's the difference of this team this year, is that, you know, every day someone else is stepping up and win ball games for us. It's not the third hitter like Justin Turner or Cody or Kershaw or me in the pan. No, it's everybody, all 25. And, you know, when you have all 25 guys like that that's doing that as a team, you know, that's when you know it's gonna be a good year. And, you know, we keep continuing to look, you know, to do this, because that's how you win championship, all 25 guys.
The way I look at it, you guys, as you said, a lot of people are helping this team win. Mm-hmm. And then you have a rookie like Cody Bellinger helping this team, coming out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. Talk about him.
He's amazing, man. I mean, he had a really bright future. You know, watching him and Corey Seager, you know, as a Dodger fan, you have to be proud of yourself, feeling proud of yourself, because, you know, the future gonna be bright for those two kids. And watching Cody doing it, man, hit homers all the time like that. Talk about missing a month, didn't even break the team, and he already had 30 homers. You know, that's very impressive. There's not a lot of people doing that, and you know, he helped us tremendously up here, and, you know, he's a big part that we're having, you know, a great run with all of the other 24 guys, you know, keep doing it day in and day out. You know, we'll be playing terrific right now.
Last year, you were awesome. This year, I think you're even better. Mm-hmm. When I say that, what do you think?
You know, the way how I grew up in my family, you know, the way how my mom and dad raised me, if someone owes you, you know, you just try to do everything to give them back. And, you know, when I signed that big deal with the Dodgers, you know, that's my way how to appreciate it and give it back to them, to come here every day and work my butt off every day to, you know, show them that how serious I am and how much we want to win a championship here. And that's what I'll be doing, man. I love this organization. You know, it's home to me, and, you know, the best thing that I ever happened to me to just play with this organization, be a big, you know, this is a huge organization, you know, in history. I mean, that's where Jackie Robinson started playing games, that give all of us a shot to play now. And I'm very thankful about that, and, you know, I'm just going to continue to come to the ballpark every day and enjoy the moment and keep working hard and try to get better every day and try to help my team win.
You had a chance to go to the Nationals, and and you decided not to go and re-sign here.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk about why you turned down the Nationals, who I understand offered more money, and decided to come back here?
Yeah, the reason why I turned the Nationals, I mean, I'm very thankful of, you know, what Rizzo did for me, for my family, how serious he was about it and how much they wanted to me. So I always will appreciate that from Washington, you know. But it's just, at the end of the day, it's just a family, you know. It's a family decision, and my family want to be in L.A. I want to be with a Dodger, you know. And like me and JT say, like, we had an unfinished business here. We see how close and how far we get last year. And, you know, the group of guys that we had hitting here, it's like family. And, you know, I want to be here with my guys. And we want to win a championship here, because, you know, win a championship here means a lot to me and for us. So, you know, that's the reason that, you know, I wanted to be here. But, you know, I'm very thankful of what Washington Nationals did for me and my family.
Talk about the reaction when the team acquired you, Darvish. I mean, this team is awesome as it is. This team is even better.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, man. It get everybody just, you know, we all kind of go to the roof, man. Like, you know, it's unbelievable when, you know, we playing so good like this, and, you know, the team make that move to go get another, you know, A starter. It just show you how much they want to win and how much, you know, they try to help us, you know, to put guys around us to us to keep go out there and fight and continue to win ball games and try to win championship. I mean, winning a championship is not easy. And, you know, they try to do everything they could do to, you know, help us try to win a World Series.
This team hasn't won a World Series since 88. And I'd like to know, how far can this team go?
I think we can go far, man. I think, you know, I like my chances this year. We had great team. Like I say, it's tough. I mean, we had the great team, but you know, it's playing in that series and, you know, give it all we have and get all we got. And we'll see how it goes. But definitely like my chances this year, the way how we playing as a group. And, you know, we got to keep continuing. Number one thing, we got to continue to stay healthy. You know, hopefully we can get Kirsch back. And, you know, for all us 25 to go and try to do the job and be great.
Final question. You have a hell of a manager in Dave Roberts. Talk about playing for him.
Man, that Doc is unbelievable, man. Just not even talk about manager right now. Just talk about family, man. You know, the way how he raised his kids, you know, being awesome. You know, I know his wife. But just see how good of a family man he is. That kind of set the tone already. And for him to come here and manage the team, you know, he's like a father to us, man, to be honest with you. Yeah, I mean, for me, definitely. I mean, you know, to just... You know, he played this game before, and he know how tough it is. And, you know, he's always there to help, to motivate you, to push you. And the way how he did it is awesome. You just feel like you want to come to the ballpark every day and continue to do it over and over and try to get better over and over again. That's how he kind of do it with me. You know, he's a big part, too, in my career right now. That, yeah. To kind of, you know, like you feel like you want to come to the ballpark and continue to be great and be even better every day, day in and day out.
What can you say about Adrian Beltre? He's going to the Hall of Fame after reaching a milestone recently. Enjoy the podcast.
Do you have to pinch yourself and ask what you accomplished, 3,000 hits? That's a big deal.
I don't think I have to pinch myself, but it was a time of my life that I would never thought about getting there because I didn't put those kind of things in my head that I want to get to any kind of hits or home runs. And when I was close enough to get to the point that I wanted to, that I was going to get there, it was surreal. But at the same time, you know, I was glad that I got there, but it was something that I would never expect myself to be there.
When did you realize you had a shot?
Well, a couple of years ago, the media started asking questions. And when the media asked questions and it started putting in your head, like, you might have a shot. So then they realized, yes, I might have a shot. Obviously, you never know how baseball, everything is unpredictable. And if I knew that I was healthy enough to play 2 or 3 years more when I realized that I was going to have a shot. And certainly I did.
There have been plenty of Dominicans who have played this game, but you're the first Dominican to reach 3,000. Is that hard to believe, and how proud are you that?
It's really hard to believe because, you know, in my country, there's a lot of really good baseball players. You mentioned, you know, Dave Ortiz, Pujols, Vladimir Guerrero, you know, Manny Ramirez. It's kind of hard to believe that I was the first one to get 3,000. Obviously, I'm proud of that, but it's something that, for me, it's not even believing that I accomplished that, but I know that it's going to be many to come because we have a lot of good baseball players that if they stay healthy, they're going to get there soon.
What I found so cute was when your children ran to you to celebrate what you accomplished, and tell me how good it was to have your children come out there.
It was the best moment of the whole situation. It was definitely the pinnacle of that milestone. When I saw my kids running the field, coming to me and unveiling that 3,000 hit sign on right field, it was something amazing. When I saw them running to me with that joy in their face, it was one of the best moments I ever had in the baseball field.
Do you realize you're a Hall of Famer?
I'm not yet.
You are a Hall of Famer. 3,000 hits, you're a Hall of Famer.
We'll see.
And your stats, your home runs, your RBIs, runs scored, I think it says it all.
We'll see.
When that happens, tell me how you feel.
When what happened?
When you get enshrined in Cooperstown.
I don't know. I haven't get there.
Talk about how much do you have left in the tank?
That's a good question. I don't know. Obviously, I had a serious injury this year that made me lose about 2 months of the season. Mm-hmm. And my body feels good now. But I want to go. I got one more year in the contract. And I'm going to play that. And after that, I'm going to go year by year. I don't know how many years I'm going to play, but I can't tell you two or three because I might be lying. But I'm going to go year by year for the body feels good, and I think that I'm capable of competing and producing the way I should for my state.
I know one of your biggest goals is to win a World Series. You came so close in 2011. How badly do you want to win a World Series?
Badly. That's the main reason why I'm still playing, because I do want to accomplish that. I've been there, but I haven't won it, and it's one of my biggest motivation to stay on the field and be healthy and produce, because I wanna come out as a champion.
Do you does this team have enough talent to at least go to the postseason? Maybe not this year, but next year.
Yeah, I think we still believe we have the talent to do it this year too. We haven't played well. We haven't played the way we should, but it's not that we have the talent to do it.
What advice would you give to Dominican kids who want to follow in your footsteps?
That never give up on their dreams. You know, if you want to accomplish something, work hard and get some discipline, because anything can happen in this life.
And my final question: you love this game,
yeah.
And I notice people love to tease you, love to pat your head. Why do you love this game?
Because it's a game. It's a game that I love, and it became that is the game that I get paid to play. For me, this was a hobby when I was a kid, and I became good at it, and it became my job. But at the same time, it's still a game. It's still a game that I love, and that I try to enjoy every time.
They sure showed how much they love you with that birthday cake.
Yeah. Thank you.
Do you love it?
I do. I mean, I don't like the attention, uh-huh. But I appreciate the gesture. Because that was really nice of those guys. That was really cool.
Do you realize what you've done? You've done a great thing.
Sometimes
people idolize you, man.
That's good to know. That's nice. But sometimes I don't get into perspective what I have done yet. Maybe when I sit down, retire, maybe I realize what I've done. But until now, it's just a game.
Thank you so much.
You got it.